Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The James S. McDonald Planetarium is clearly one of the most important assets in the region, and today it's observing its 50th anniversary. Think of how much we have learned about the world of astronomy since April 16, 1963. The U.S. space program was launched with a lot of help from St. Louis's McDonnell aircraft, later McDonnell Douglas, helping man's conquest of space. The Hubble telescope gave us a close-up look at the far regions of space. We scouted Mars and even demoted a planet. Yet there is still so much to learn. The man who became the first director of our planetarium was only 25 years old when he took the job. He is Charles Schweighauser, currently professor emeritus of astronomy physics at the University of Illinois Springfield. He joins me in studio. Also with us, Norm Beckel. He's a retiree from McDonnell Douglas and was with McDonnell Aircraft's Mercury and Gemini spacecraft launch teams. A little later, we'll be joined by Jenny Heim, Director of Strategic Planning and Projects at the St. Louis Science Center and in charge of the new exhibit, Gateway to the Universe, 50 Years of the James S. McDonnell Planetarium. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. Nice to have you. Charles, let me begin with you. I am fascinated by the fact that you took over the helm at the planetarium when you're only 25 years old. Tell me about how you got that job at such a young age.
Well, I was teaching here in St. Louis and teaching astronomy, among other things. And one of my students' parents mentioned to me that a new planetarium was being built in Forest Park and that I ought to apply for the directorship. And I said, no, they want somebody with some experience. But I applied anyway and got the job.
Well, were you surprised that at 25 you did get that job?
That's right. I was actually appointed director on the day before my 25th birthday.
Wow. Well, that's quite an accomplishment in and of itself. What an exciting time, not only for you personally, but also because the country was just starting to look with a little more intensity towards those skies and the stars.
That's right. It was a very exciting time. As a matter of fact, my whole career, the last 50 years, has been the best time ever to be an astronomer. We've learned so much, and we have so much to learn. It's just been extraordinarily exciting.
What were the challenges as you saw them during those early days? Obviously, when you took the job, the planetarium physically had not been constructed
yet. That's right. Well, it was about half finished, and we still had to finish the building. We had to put in the planetarium projector. It came from Japan in many crates and many different pieces, and the technicians from Japan had to put it together. Of course, we had to hire a staff. We had to train the staff. So there was an enormous amount of work. I actually worked about 18 months before we opened the planetarium.
So what is your approach in putting all this together? I mean, how do you look at what you have to do and what you want to be able to make available to the public?
Well, one of the things that I did was to travel around the country and visit other planetariums and see what they were doing. I went to New York to the Hayden Planetarium. I went to Chicago to the Adler Planetarium. I went to the Buell Planetarium in Pittsburgh. I went to the Fells Planetarium in Philadelphia to see what other planetariums were doing, how they were running their public shows, and what other kinds of programs they had. And to that, then, we added some things that we thought we should be doing here in St. Louis, a school program, teaching at the universities here in St. Louis, and so forth.
Well, you had mentioned to me off the air that you were doing a lot of teaching in those days and teaching students from all of the local universities.
That's right. There were three universities in St. Louis at the time, Washington University, St. Louis University, and UMSL was just getting started. And we had students from all three universities come to the planetarium to take courses from us.
Yeah. Well, let me bring Norm into the conversation, because if it was an exciting time for Charles, Norm, it must have been for you, too, out there at McDonnell Aircraft, as it was known in those days.
Yes, it was. You know, the manned space program was just getting started with Mercury. We were basically, a lot of us were very young engineers, and it was a time that going to work was, it really wasn't work, it was a lot of fun. And we just, you know, we're in on the ground floor or something that was remarkable.
How did it happen that McDonnell got the contracts for Mercury and then later Gemini?
Well, it's my understanding they competed. It actually happened before I came to McDonnell, like in the 56, 57 time frame. And they competed with seven or eight other large aerospace industries, and McDonnell was just a little airplane company
exactly
out there in the Midwest. And surprise, surprise, McDonnell came up with the plan that NASA liked, and so was awarded the contract.
What were the challenges you faced, you and your fellow team members, during this particular time?
Well, the problem was is everything was new.
Yeah.
The technology was new. Transistors, a lot of people didn't even know what a transistor is today, but they were just coming into being. A lot of our mercury hardware still had vacuum tubes in them. And there was no such things as microprocessors and things like that that we have today. But just the sheer fact of being able to take all this equipment and put it together and then put a man in there. And at the same time, the missile developments were really in an infant stage. And, you know, we were developing all these missiles, the Atlas and Titans and Poseidons and Polaris's and Minutemen. We're all being – and they were all being – having their struggles trying to get off the ground, so to speak.
Now, we have to remind our audience that the time we're talking about was really at the height of the Cold War.
Yes.
And that the armament part of it was extremely important, as was the space part of it, because we were in a space race in those days.
Yes, we were. And if you recall, our first – the Russians beat us with Sputnik, but that came about because President Eisenhower decided we were going to launch. We had capability to launch, but we were going to do it with a Navy missile. And I'm not saying anything against the Navy. I was a member of the Navy. But at any rate, that missile was not capable, or at least failed, putting the first satellite in. So the Russians beat us. And so everything was gauged then against the Russians. You know, they put the first Sputnik in space. They put the first man, dog in space. They put the first man in space.
Yuri Gagarin.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And so it took us a little while to get off the ground. But as you know, in the 60s, we went from not having any men in space to putting a man on the moon.
Of course. And Charles, you're watching all of this, I'm sure, in abject fascination, what was going on around the corner, so to speak.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, of course, one of the big developments in my field was putting satellites above our atmosphere so that we could study the universe in X-rays and infrared and ultraviolet and other parts of the radio spectrum that we did not have access to here on the surface of the Earth. And that gave us enormous insights into the universe.
When was it that that President Kennedy said that we were going to go to the moon before the end of the decade?
That was 1962.
62,
right.
Okay.
Right, yep.
What is your recollection of that, and what did you feel
It's a wonderful recollection because I happened to be in a meeting. We were at Pere Marquette, and James Webb, who was director of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, was a member of our conference group and when Kennedy made the announcement. And, of course, that was a huge success, as you know, but it was also a huge announcement at that time.
Did you – do you recall if you thought that that was possible, a possible feat in 1962?
Oh, sure. Because we'd been thinking about it for a long time. Way back in the 20s and 30s, people were thinking about putting a man on the moon. And I'm not talking about science fiction now. I'm talking about real scientists and real engineers and so forth. Mm-hmm. We're thinking about that. So the question was, could we do it in a short amount of time that the president suggested? And the answer was, we did it.
We did it, but as Norm has indicated, the Russians were a few steps – the Soviets, I should say, to put it properly, were a few steps ahead of us.
They were at the time, but we not only caught up, we passed them very quickly, and there never was a race to the moon. The Russians never got into that race. It was – we were racing against ourselves and did a magnificent job.
Let me get the thoughts of both of you, and I'll start with you, Norm, with regard to our space program today. It seems to have been kind of put on hold. It certainly has taken a back seat to where it once was.
Well, there isn't as much going on in the, you know, the news people. TV likes things like putting a man on the moon and things like that. But as far as putting a now when they put the vehicle on Mars, that drew some attention, but it quickly fades. But there is a lot of things going on. There's still plans. NASA's still very actively working for manned space exploration. And there are, of course, every time you turn your GPS on, you know that there's a satellite up there, or actually a family of satellites. So, you know, the space efforts are still there. We're still spending a lot of money on them, and not as much as we'd like to, those of us who are in the space business. But there is still a lot of work being done. And when the spectacular events occur, then the news people will broadcast them. But in the meantime, there's still in the universities, NASA, even the military is very actively involved in carrying out this space. Now, I will say one thing. It's sort of interesting, the two viewpoints here between Charles thinking that putting a man on the moon was possible. Those of us who were working in the hardware business were not so sure about this, because in 1962, we were launching Mercury's. Mercury was very non-demanding. We could launch it any time, any day. Didn't make any difference. We just liked nice weather, that's all. But Gemini came along, and we were trying to put two vehicles in orbit and make them match up. And so the timing had to be very precise on the launches. You could only launch a certain day at a certain time. And that was very difficult in 1962. And then you look ahead at what had to be done to put a man on the moon. You know, those of us in the hardware business weren't so sure. Well, you know, we were hopeful.
I don't think anybody thought that it was going to be easy. But no. You two aren't going to get into a fight here.
Oh no! I'm just saying that the two viewpoints. Or you know,
sure. No, I understand. I understand, Charles. How about you? Before we take our break, in terms of the idea of NASA or their space program kind of being put on hold.
Well, from an astronomical point of view, we've got a lot of programs underway right now. There are a lot of satellites up there. We have the James Webb Space Telescope, which is going up hopefully in 2018, which will increase our knowledge of the universe by orders of magnitude. Of course, we've had Hubble up since 89. There are other space probes that are up there. The Planck, for example, which is a European endeavor, the WMAP. There are just all kinds of things that are up there. So, we never have enough. But on the other hand, we have quite a bit. As a matter of fact, there is so much data coming in from the satellites now, we don't have enough people to analyze it. Mm-hmm. That is astronomers, astrophysicists, physicists, and so forth.
Well, that has to be a problem.
It is a problem. That's right. We can't train people fast enough to analyze the data coming back from the satellites we already have.
Ah, well, we'll pick up on that point when we come back. We have to take a break. You've just heard from Charles Schweighauser. He's the first director of McDonnell Planetarium. Also with me in studio is Norm Beckel. He was with McDonnell Aircraft's Mercury and Gemini spacecraft launch teams. We'll come back and continue. This is, by the way, as I mentioned earlier on, if you missed it, the 50th anniversary of McDonnell Planetarium. That's why we're having this discussion. And if you'd like to become a part of it, we would certainly like to welcome you. So give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382 to talk. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air, and you can also reach us through Facebook. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation in observance of the 50th anniversary of McDonnell Planetarium. My guests in studio are Norm Beckel. He was with the McDonnell Aircraft's Mercury and Gemini space capsule launch teams way back when, late 50s and 60s and beyond. And also with me in studio is Charles Schweighauser, first director of McDonnell Planetarium. That goes back to 1961 when the appointment came and the planetarium opened in 63. Is that right, Charles?
That's exactly correct, yeah. Right.
You know, you mentioned just before we took that break about the lack of some of the people on the ground to be evaluating the information that is coming to us from all this stuff that's out there. And we've done programs recently on this as a problem in the United States. Math proficiency down, the sciences are not generating the number of graduates that we actually need. How do you look at this situation and how do we improve that?
Well, one of the ways to improve it, of course, is to involve more women. And that's on the upswing right now. The latest data from the American Astronomical Society is that 28% of the assistant professors, that is, people who are just getting started in their careers as astronomers, astrophysicists, physicists, and so forth, are women. And that's good. In 1963, I could have counted on the fingers in one hand the number of women who were making contributions to our understanding of the universe. Well, that's not true anymore. Also, one-third of the physics majors, undergraduate physics majors, are now women in the top universities in the country. We're tapping the other half of our population, and that's really good. And so that's one way of creating the astronomers, the astrophysicists, the physicists, the data analysts, the computer people that we need to keep up with the satellites.
It's going to take some time, however, I guess, to fill that void.
Sure. I mean, yeah. It's 8 or 10 years to a PhD and from undergraduate work. And it's going to take some time, but we're on the way.
Norm, do you have any thoughts about why it is that so many of our young people, young men in particular, are not turning toward the science world?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that is turning around a little bit because I think people are starting to recognize and boys are starting to recognize that things like mathematics generally come reasonably easy to boys. At least it did to me.
Not this boy. Sorry to say.
And, you know, there are a lot of things going on now at our retirees' luncheon here. A couple months ago, we had some executives from the Boeing company. And they were lamenting the same thing, and they've started these STEM programs, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, because we have to start developing our young people. Our young people aren't any brighter or any dumber than they've ever been. It's just a matter of getting their attention geared towards these things and what an exciting world it is for you when you're in one of these fields. I mean, it's just flabbergasting for those of us who have been in it and enjoyed it. And even the Boy Scouts have a similar STEM program going, and their merit badges trying to encourage boys. And I was at a court of honor last night, and some young lad, about 11 or 12 years old, he had this science technology merit badge, and he looked like a little Einstein is what he reminded me of. You know, you just, like Charles said, first of all, you got to tap into all your resources. You can't exclude anybody because they're man or woman or tall or short or anything else. You've got to take your total population base and try to encourage people, make this an exciting thing. When people get excited, when they use their cell phone and if they understand the technology that it takes to make that cell phone, and it's not just something to be talking with.
Sure.
They might get excited about these things.
Well, the young people I know are plenty excited about their cell phones. Yeah. They use them for virtually everything. Charles, luring people into this whole field, what are the big challenges? I keep using this word, but what is the biggest mystery out there that is solvable by the next generation, do you think?
Oh, there are lots of mysteries. For example, dark matter. We know how much is there. We know where it is, but we haven't the foggiest notion what it is. Dark energy, which makes up most of the universe, incidentally, the mass energy of the universe. We think it's everywhere, but we haven't the foggiest notion what it is. And that's if you add dark energy and dark matter together, that makes 95% of the universe we don't know very much about. And we know a little bit about the other 5%. So the challenges are there. The opportunities are there. And I can't believe that people, that young people won't accept those challenges because there is so much to learn. In 1963, we thought we knew a great deal. In 2013, I'm not so sure we know quite so much.
We've only learned how much we don't know.
That's exactly right. And that's the first step toward knowledge and wisdom.
How about the last 50 years? What is the most important discovery in the world of astronomy since the planetarium opened?
That's very hard to answer. One of the discoveries is occurred in 1998, or at least the papers were published in 1998. And that is shortly after the Big Bang, the universe was expanding, but it was slowing down because of gravity, because of the mass energy of the universe. And in 1998, two papers were published that indicated that the universe about halfway through its history, that is about 7 billion years ago, was starting to speed up. And that's the dark energy that I was mentioning. And we don't know why. And that's one of the great things we have to learn. And what that means is, what does that mean for the future of the universe? 60 billion years from now, what's the universe going to look like? Is there going to be a rip in space and time? We don't know that. Very interesting questions that we are facing.
The Hubble telescope, you alluded to that earlier, and we've seen some wonderful images that have come as a result of it. What has that taught us? What have we learned through Hubble?
The Hubble telescope was a discovery machine. It was the most important telescope since Galileo invented the first astronomical telescope in 1609. It has taught us so much about the universe, about galaxies, about the deep universe. It has taken us back more than 10 billion years in the history of the universe. We now know that the universe is about 13.8 billion years old. At least that's our current understanding. So we're looking back now over most of the history of the universe. And, of course, every time we look into space, we're looking back into time, too, because of the finite speed of light. So the Hubble has been just an enormous success. And it's going to be followed by the James Webb Space Telescope, which we'll be able to, we hope will launch in about 5 years and will tell us even more. We now are able to get data, that is optical data as well as infrared data, from about 600 million years after the Big Bang. But there's still a blank in there that we don't understand very much about. We still call it the Dark Ages of about 600 million years, which, of course, in astronomical time is practically nothing.
It's practically nothing.
Right.
I have to ask this question. I'm sure it's on a lot of people's minds. Are we ever going to find some form of life out there?
You know, it would be a very strange universe if we were the only forms of life, wouldn't it?
Yep.
And I call this the extension of the Copernican metaphor. Copernicus showed us that the sun was the center of the universe. This was back in the 16th century. And that denied the geocentric or the earth-centered universe of Aristotle and the Greeks. And then the extension of the Copernican metaphor was that we're not the center of our galaxy, the Milky Way. As a matter of fact, now, based on Einstein's special theory of relativity, there is no center to the universe. And the extension of the Copernican metaphor would be that we would find life. And it's, as I say, it would be a very strange universe indeed if there were not some other forms of life. That doesn't necessarily mean sentiency, intelligent life, but any kind of life someplace else in the universe.
We might even find it on Mars.
We might find it on Mars, right.
Norm, what do you think? Do you buy into that? Do you think there's a life form out there somewhere?
Well, I think that Charles said some form of life. I don't think you're going to find people like us, human beings, that form of life. But I don't really know.
none of us does know, but it's certainly fun to talk about. Yeah. And given the fact that we are able to learn so much over relatively short periods of time, who knows? Maybe during our lifetimes we'll know more.
When you think how the knowledge keeps increasing so fast that It's like warp speed.
Yep. Let's go to the phones. Not surprisingly, we have a number of people who want to talk to you, gentlemen. Let's start with Jerry calling from O'Fallon, Missouri. Jerry, thanks for being with us once again. Go ahead.
Well, good morning. My first visit to the planetarium was in 1967. I was 10 years old. And I got a glimpse into the future, but not in the way that you've been discussing. It was a grade school field trip. And when they were talking about the various features and they, you know, the projector came on and everything, it was kind of like the punchline of a joke when the announcer mentioned that the projector had been made in Japan, because up to that point, our concept of Japanese technology were mainly the tin toy cars and things like that. So, you know, if I'd been more observant, I, you know, would have known the future was coming. And the future of technology would be coming from Japan. So, anyway.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Well, Charles, you're very familiar with that,
yes,
that technology.
Yes, that's right. And the reason that the GOTO, G-O-T-O, planetarium projector was chosen over other projectors is that GOTO was the only company that agreed to meet the specifications that were written by the Planetarium Commission. This occurred before I started, as a matter of fact. And that's why the Japanese instrument was chosen.
Let's take another call, and we'll bring in Phil calling from Shrewsbury. Phil, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. How is everybody today?
Great. How are you?
Great. Thank you, sir. I was born in 1963, and I always wanted to be a pilot, but I never got that chance. But it was interesting. I enjoyed the show, and I just think that you made made space more attractive, maybe, you know, there would be more of the STEM people trying to get into the field of the you know, the sciences and stuff of that sort. And I just appreciate the show, and I just want to thank you for all y'all do.
Okay, Phil, you say make space more attractive. You mean the study of astronomy and the space sciences?
Yeah, I think so. It's like I'm not even exactly sure what I'm trying to say. I just know that I wanted to be a pilot. I never got that chance.
Well, sorry for that, but thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so kindly.
Let's talk to Tom in South County. Go ahead, Tom. You're on the air.
Thank you. I hope this is the kind of question that all of us would-be engineers and pilots and would-be scientists are interested in. I think I was in the planetarium, and I saw one of the actual Mercury or Gemini spacecraft and peered in there, and I could see that there was a whole panel of what looked like these brass flip switches, like toggle switches. And I thought, boy, that looks like an awful primitive technology for a spacecraft, little AB switches. And I thought, well, probably the reason that they put that up in there is that you want something that you understand really well and that you know is not going to fail, because you only get one chance in space, I guess. Is that the way that works from an engineering perspective?
Let's ask the man who was there. Go ahead, Norm Beckel.
Well, it was primitive. By today's standards, it's sort of like the Flintstone, and those were toggle switches. And the logic circuits that we used were basically switch-driven. Now we do that electronically, of course. We do the same thing. But you're right. I mean, the people who were doing this design were using things called slide rules, which was most people don't even know what a slide rule is now. But in those days, that's what we had at our disposal. We did not have computers. There was no such thing as a microprocessor. And so, yes, it does. As a matter of fact, even today, when I look in there and I think, I can't believe we put a man in space with that stuff.
Charles, how have computers helped your field during these 50 years?
Oh, and unbelievably. For example, we have two research observatories at the university, and all we do is go in, punch in some numbers in a computer, the telescope. We haven't even opened the dome yet. The telescope finds it. We open the dome, and there it is, right in the telescope. Mm-hmm. So it's made it very easy for us, as a matter of fact. Our telescope is able to find anything in the sky that's available to us.
Including space junk.
Including space junk,
of which there is a considerable amount, I'm sure.
There is. That's exactly correct. Yep, right. Although we don't study that, I must say. We're interested in astronomical objects.
We had just had a call from someone, and we lost it concerning the space junk. Maybe they'll call back. Let me read an email from Marty here. He writes, one of the issues in getting girls into STEM, that's the science, technology, and engineering and math that we were talking about before, is to avoid characterizing scientists and engineers as little Einsteins. The way scientists and engineers are characterized is critical to girls' expectations in the field. And I think a lot of people don't like the word girls either while we're at it. But anyway, that's the word he's using. They don't want to be Einsteins. They want to solve problems that face them in society. Give them a problem that's relevant. The girls will dive in. Avoid competitive situations. That's what turns boys on, but not girls necessarily. Let them see the value of the problem and get out of their way. What do you think, Charles?
Well, from my experience in teaching for years and for decades at the university, in my introductory course for non-science majors, we would always have more women than we would have men. My introductory course that required calculus had very few women. And I think the reason is because they were afraid of the math. And, of course, in the advanced courses, we got very few women. The ones we got were excellent, incidentally. I think one of the problems is it's a sociological problem, and that is that when they're growing up, young girls are told that they're going to be the home economists and the boys are going to be the engineers. And we've got to get away from that kind of mindset. And I'd like to make one other point here, and that is that from my experience, there is absolutely no difference between men and women when it comes to math. They're both equally good, and we just have to convince the women that they're as good as the men are.
All right.
Well, or better.
Or better, right. And in so many cases, they are. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. You just heard from Charles Schweighauser, first director of McDonald Planetarium. This is the 50th anniversary of our planetarium, such an important asset in this community. Also with us is Norm Beckel. He was with McDonald Aircraft, as it was known then, Mercury and Gemini space capsule launch teams way back in the late 50s and early 60s. And when we come back, Jenny Heim will join us. She's director of strategic planning and projects at the St. Louis Science Center. We'll take more of your calls as well. 382-8255 is the number. Give us a call if you have a question or a recollection about maybe some experience you've had at the planetarium or the science center. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on this, the 50th anniversary of the McDonald Planetarium at the Science Center in Forest Park. We're joined in studio by Jenny Heim, Director of Strategic Planning and Projects at the St. Louis Science Center. Jenny, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
And thanks for waiting. Well, what have you heard so far that has struck you as you've been listening to these gentlemen?
Well, you know, the conversation about the need for more people to be involved in STEM careers and for more young people to get excited about science and technology and engineering and math really is the heart of the St. Louis Science Center. I mean, we feel like we are the perfect place for young people to have a very positive and successful experience with science, explore their curiosity, and then perhaps pursue it as a career.
What are you seeing with regard to visitors and visits by young people? Is it on the increase, perhaps, or is the enthusiasm level high, moderate, or getting higher all the time?
At the Science Center, we see people who are having a great time with science, and particularly in the area of space science and astronomy. That seems to be on an uptick based on you know, both our visitation and also just sort of general, you know, what we see out in the world as far as people expressing their interest. You mentioned the recent Mars rover, and there just is a lot going on to fuel people's interest.
What about women visitors, young women?
We have, yes, I mean, we see definitely young boys, young girls, and we have a number of programs that are somewhat more specifically aimed at young girls to some extent to address that gap. But yeah, we see strong interest from both genders.
Well, you've heard part of our conversation in which the women really seem to be turning toward these fields and how important that is to get more people in the bullpen for the science activity. You're here primarily to tell us about how the 50th anniversary is going to be observed, not only today, but in the future weeks. Give us kind of the capsulized version, if you will. We have a number of calls. Folks want to get into
all
the
right. Well, we see this celebration as an opportunity to thank the St. Louis community for their support over the last 50 years, and we want them to come to the planetarium. As part of the celebration, we're offering 1963 prices for planetarium shows. So that's 50 cents for a planetarium show. And we hope that people will come, you know, get reacquainted with the planetarium and also invest in the future. We, in our exhibition, we present some ideas for future exhibits and programs and even for possible seating in the planetarium. And we want to get people's input.
You have got a nice big golden bow wrapped around that planetarium right now. And I think, Charles, this all started a little bit after your time, but the bow is really become a symbol in and of itself at the planetarium, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. It started as a prank, December 1966, by a group of architecture students from Washington University. They cooked up the idea, I think, that fall. And they spent a couple of months putting the plan together. They had the actual plans for the building. And we connected with a couple of those pranksters as we were working on the exhibition and interviewed them and got their story. But St. Louis then really took ownership of that bow. Actually, they said that the next year the planetarium called them and said, right, could you do that again? And they said, no, it was a one-time deal for us. But the Science Center took it on. One year we didn't do it. The planetarium was merging with the Museum of Science and Natural History. The building was closed. People thought it might be confusing if we put the bow up. So in 1984, they didn't put the bow up, and they heard about it. And they got phone calls and lots of complaints. So we learned we don't mess with the bow.
Well, you know, Charles, it's interesting. It is something as simple as that and as innocently conceived as that was, it draws so much attention to that facility and in its own way may have inspired some young people to come into the field that we've been talking about all morning.
It certainly would. And I would just like to mention the building, too, if I may. In my humble opinion, it is one of the great pieces of architecture sculpture in the world. And we're so fortunate to have it here in St. Louis because it gets you just doing what you're supposed to do. As you walk up to the building, it gets you to look up. And that's what astronomers do.
Right. And whoever designed it must have been pretty good at math, too, because it required a lot of calculations to make that work.
That's right. Gil Obata was the chief architect on it. Right.
Before I forget to mention this, and I just want to be sure that everyone knows that Charles is going to be speaking tonight at the Science Center at 7 o'clock. It's free. Reservations are encouraged. Isn't that right, Jenny?
Yes, and it's filling up quickly, but we do have a few spots available. So we encourage people to call 289-4424, and they can make a reservation for tonight's program.
We'll have information on our website,
289-4424.
Okay, and we have that information on our website at slpublicradio.org. Let's go back to the phones and everybody participate when the questions come in, and we'll see where we go with this. Let's begin with Warren calling from University City. Go ahead, Warren.
Yes, my question is, before there was a universe, if there was such a thing as before the universe, what was there?
Oh, you've given him an easy one.
Yeah. Well, that, of course, we don't know, because science operates by taking observations and interpreting those observations and trying to explain them. And if we can't get observations before the universe, then we have no way of explaining it. Now, people have tried to explain it, but that's all pretty far out theory. I'm not talking about science fiction. I'm talking about real scientists, theoreticians who try to explain. But we need the data. And so if we get data, then we'll be able to tell something more about that. There is a theory that was first published as a PhD thesis at Princeton in the 1950s that suggests a multiverse rather than a universe, that new universes are being created all the time. This theory was forgotten, but it has come back and is part of, I won't say mainstream astrophysics right now, but at least some attention is being paid to it, and basically through the development of string theory.
I think Frank, joining us from Fenton, wants to get into this particular subject as well. Go ahead, Frank. You're on the air.
Yeah, my question kind of intersects with Warren's there. You know, I know the holy grail of this whole thing is getting back to just the instant of the Big Bang. And my question kind of goes even further than that. You know, there was this super dense, super small matter that created this whole thing. Is there any speculation as to what that was, or is it some kind of an ongoing thing? It just keeps going over and over again, kind of with the string theory thing. Or does anybody have any viable speculation? It seems like it's almost kind of intersecting between science and almost spirituality or something. It just that's always been mind-boggling to me. And if I wonder if your guest, first of all, I'd like to thank you and congratulations to the planetarium and everything. And had a question. So thanks a lot,
Frank. Thanks. Go ahead. Would you like to take that, Charles?
Okay. Well, first of all, our current physics, when we think about the early universe, can take us back to 10^-43 of a second. We can't go back any farther because our physics breaks down at that point. I'm talking about Einstein's general relativity, his theory of gravity, and I'm talking about the standard theory of particle physics. It can only take us back to 10^-43 of a second. So we don't know what happened from the Big Bang to that point, although there is some speculation that when, at that point, the universe was 10^-28 of a centimeter in size, and that's nine orders of magnitude smaller than a proton, the whole universe. And then it went through a period of inflation. And that period of inflation occurred from 10^-35 of a second to 10^-32 of a second, when the universe went from 10^-28 of a centimeter in size to the size of a grapefruit or a softball, which means that it expanded faster than the speed of light, which seems to deny or contradict Einstein's special theory of relativity. But you have to realize that what was expanding was the space of the universe. As long as matter was not involved, the space can expand faster than the speed of light, and that's what was happening. So this was an enormous expansion that took place in a very, very, very short period of time.
Jenny and Norm, I hope we're not going to get a pop quiz on that.
I agree.
It's just fascinating to know so much about that, to have been able to evaluate what information we do have to come up with it.
Well, I would just add that what we really are looking for is an addition to or a new physics. And the Large Hadron Collider, which is in Europe, it was announced on January 4th that it discovered something that behaved like the Higgs boson. And it was only running at half power when it did that. And what we're hoping for is when it gets up to full steam, that it will be able to give us a new physics. We need a new physics to explain not only the beginning of the Big Bang, but lots of things that happen after that where we have some holes that we don't understand.
Well, I hope there are a lot of young people listening who are intrigued and attracted by the kinds of things that we're talking about here, because we need them. And the next generation is going to probably be the one that discovers some of these things we're talking about. Let's return to the phones and have Sharon join us from St. Louis. Sharon, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'll be brief because I know we're short on time. What I wanted to know was what's the salary for things like this? I know lots and lots of amateur astronomers, and I have a child myself who's in college right now, and he's not interested in astronomy because there's no paycheck for it. You know, it's cool looking at the stars and all and knowing these things, but there's no... He doesn't see a demand for it the way he does see a demand for other careers. So when he was in high school looking for careers, astronomy didn't even cross his plate. It didn't cross the plate of anyone at his school. Do you guys have a way of dealing with that? I sure hope so.
Okay. Well, the caller is absolutely correct, and that is that astronomical salaries are not great. But on the other hand, one doesn't do astronomy because of the salary, one to make money. One does it because of the intellectual challenge, the intellectual stimulation, and astronomy asks the most important questions that we human beings can ask. In other words, who are we, where do we come from, and where are we going? And if we can help add answers to those questions, that is satisfaction. That's plenty. I will add one other thing. Astronomy jobs are difficult to find, particularly tenure-track jobs in universities, just because universities have tended to go toward job courses that and majors that promote jobs and money and have not poured a whole lot of money into astronomy. But I think that that's going to change, and there's plenty of opportunity there if we can just find the money.
Go ahead, Jenny.
I think also in encouraging people to consider the wide variety of science careers out there, including astronomy, is to have role models. And I think we're seeing some exciting role models with some of the you know, with the Curiosity rover on Mars. People were talking about Mohawk Man at the JPL laboratory. And we have a lot of great role models here in St. Louis. There are, you know, a group at Washington University that's very involved in the current Mars exploration program. And Dr. Ray Arvidson from that program is going to be speaking at the planetarium in August. So the idea that you might get to operate one of those rovers on Mars, I think, is exciting to a lot of young people.
I'm sure it would be. I think we have time for one more call. We'll bring in Jay, who's been in Marthasville, who's been waiting for the entire program. Thanks for doing so, Jay. Make it quick, though, please.
Well, I just wanted to say hello to Dr. Schweighausen because he came into a meeting of the St. Louis Astronomical Society one night and asked for volunteers to run the telescopes on top of the planetarium. And I and a fellow named Al Woods were the only two volunteers, and we did that for a couple of years. Anyway. Hello, Charles. How are you?
I'm just fine. Thank you. Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Jay?
Yes.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Do you have something you wanted to add?
Well, yeah. I was always curious, whatever happened to the good old L1 projector? I heard it was put in crates and in storage at McDonald's in a warehouse someplace and just... And somebody lost the instructions on how to put it together. It was all in Japanese, and nobody could...
Thanks for that. We'll see if we can get an answer. Jenny, you look like you might know something about that.
Yes, that we looked into that as we were researching the exhibition. It was, you know, it was crated up and stored at McDonald's, and they had a buyer for it, so it was going to go to another home. But then something that didn't quite work out, so it did end up in storage.
So it's,
although we do have some of those manuals, and they were in English and Japanese. So
I can't take the call, but one of the callers asks if the Gemini capsule is on display. Is it still on display over there at the planetarium?
Yes, we have both a Gemini spacecraft and a Mercury spacecraft on display. They are on loan from the National Air and Space Museum. And we couple it with, we profile somebody who worked with Norman at McDonnell Aircraft, Alex Stravinsky. And we have a lot of artifacts related to him, including his slide rule and also pictures from when he was in Florida working on the launch.
So if you want to see examples of his work and Norm Beckel's work, go on over to the planetarium and it's right there. Time is up. Went so quickly by today. I want to thank you all for being with us. Jenny, thanks for coming in and bringing us up to speed on that. Norm Beckel, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Congratulations
on
a great career with McDonnell and later with Boeing. And Charles Schweighauser, thank you so much for being with us. A reminder that he will be speaking this evening at the Science Center at 7 o'clock. It's free. Reservations encouraged. The phone number to call is, I hope I have this right, 289-4424
yes.
With a 314 area code. Thank you, sir, so much for being with us.
And my pleasure.
Thank you for all you've done for our community and for the folks up there in Springfield at the University of Illinois.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the work the organization Girls on the Run does to empower, educate, and prepare girls for a healthy life. Then we'll take a look at former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's 1996 visit to Westminster College in Fulton. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.